Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, it's Hamish from the Young Investors Podcast. Myself and Brandon are excited to bring you your weekly rundown of the latest business and investing news from around the world. Now, a quick reminder before we get into the podcast is that nothing in this podcast should be taken on as personal financial advice. If you're ever unsure about your finances or investing, make sure you reach out to a qualified financial advisor. But with that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to episode 272. I'm joined by Mr. Brandon van der Kolk. As always, where are you? You look like you're in a closet or something. Or you're in the sauna or...
I feel like I'm in a closet. No, I've got the window over there. I'm currently in Mollymook. So just getting away down the coast for a couple of days. But unfortunately, we've come here, we've gotten here, and it's just been pouring rain. So I'm hoping that we get a couple of days where it's good weather, but it's not looking likely.
Ah, that's unfortunate. Yeah, Melbourne's been like the complete opposite. We've had some insane March weather. It's just been like 30s. Last week was like 37 every single day over the weekend, which is insane. I don't even think we had a weekend like that during summer in the last like 3 years. I can't remember. Which is crazy. So yeah, Melbourne's had some great weather.
Yeah, summer has arrived very, very late. Yes. It's been so weird. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. As long as it's here. I need warm days.
Yeah, me too. I like the warm. Anyway, how you been? What you been up to?
I'm doing well. Just finished my next video. Should be coming out soon, which is nice. Exciting. So I don't know. Yeah.
What's the topic?
I went through another one of Ray Dalio's memos. He kind of went through and spoke about some of the indicators that he looks at for assessing kind of how expensive the market looks. And it's actually a really interesting deep dive. So I'm looking forward to bringing that video out. Yeah.
Nice. Very good. All right. What are we talking about today, Hamish?
We've got a bit of a mixed bag. I'm going to talk about US inflation. We've got February data for US inflation and as a bit of a teaser, it's running a little bit hotter than was previously expected. So we'll talk about that. We've still got some banking problems, even a year later after all of the banking shenanigans that went on last year. There are still banks going through problems. We'll talk about one in particular. You've got the potential for TikTok to be being banned in the US. And then what else have you got?
I got a little funny story for you. I'll talk about that one first. It's a bit of a funny one.
All right, fantastic.
But it revolves around our good friend Sam Bankman-Fried. Oh. You know him? You went to high school with him.
Yeah, fantastic.
Hamish definitely did not go to high school with Sam Bankman-Fried.
No, just that would anyone. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe missed it by a few years.
I don't even know how old he is. Yeah, he's probably a bit older, isn't he? He's probably older than me. He's probably in his 30s, isn't he? Or is he even older than that?
Yeah, I think he's in his 30s. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he doesn't look like he is, but he's a lot older than me.
Anyway, lots to talk about today, Hamish. Lots to talk about.
So, with that said, today's episode is brought to you by Seeking Alpha, your one-stop shop for stock analysis, market data, and news. Access expert analysis and news for thousands of stocks, view buy, hold, and sell ratings from members, Wall Street analysts, and Seeking Alpha's own algorithm. Screen for stocks using a variety of fundamental and technical analysis metrics. Access 10 years of financial data and company filings, and manage your portfolio by tracking your investments with price alerts so you never miss a buying opportunity again. Click the link in the episode description or head directly to seekingalpha.me/younginvestors to try Seeking Alpha free for 7 days.
Very good.
You take us through what's going on with Sammy? What's going on?
Look, honestly, it's not a huge story. I've hyped it up into more than it is, but it is pretty funny. Firstly, the first known jailhouse photo of Sam Bankman-Fried has emerged, and we can chuck that up on screen right now, but I've put it in the Google Doc as well if you wanted to have a look, Hamish.
Yeah.
Have you seen that photo? Have you seen that one floating
around? Yeah, I've seen this photo. Yeah, it's great.
And he's not looking too happy. He's somehow perfectly managed to maintain his look of nerdiness, but also, I'm so sad, I don't want to be in prison.
poor guy.
But yes, of course, Sam Bankman-Fried, the founder of failed crypto exchange FTX, is being photographed in prison. And what's very interesting, this is the funny part, he is coping with his jail time by learning how to trade fish for services from other inmates. Yes, a source told the Wall Street Journal that Bankman-Fried recently exchanged tins of mackerel for a haircut from another inmate in an effort to maintain his, quote, signature mop top.
Wait.
The fish has become... Yeah.
Wait, what?
He's trading fish? Yeah. Yeah, so I think there's like these vending machines or something, because it says here mackerel costs... it's at the commissary. Mackerel costs $1.30 at the jail commissary. While one of the more expensive items is an MP3 player, which costs $88.40. But it turns out the fish has become the most popular commissary item ever since the Brooklyn Metropolitan Detention Center banned cigarettes, the outlet reported. So inmates frequently trade the mackerel for services from each other. So,
right, okay. So I guess cigarettes probably used to be like the currency, but now it's fish.
Yeah.
I love how that's like the second... I can't get a cigarette.
We have a strong fish-based economy.
But yeah, I can get a tin of fish. Somehow that's equivalent. That's hilarious.
Pretty funny. Bankman-Fried has been in the facility since August. He's being held without bail after federal judge found that he tried to intimidate a witness, harassed his former girlfriend, Caroline Ellison, and gave documents to reporters. The former crypto king denied the allegations. He's currently awaiting sentencing on 7 felonies related to conspiracy and fraud. This is all stuff we know. He's been convicted of stealing billions from FTX customers and defrauding investors and lenders. Prosecutors allege that Bankman-Fried took money from customers and used it to pay off debts tied to Alameda Research, a hedge fund he founded in 2017. He'll be moved to a federal correctional facility after his sentencing hearing, which is scheduled for the 28th of March this year. He's facing a maximum of 110 years in prison.
Yeah, so 28th of March. That's
pretty soon. It's
pretty
soon.
Yeah, that was one of our predictions, right? I think we made a prediction of how many years he would end up getting. I don't exactly remember what we predicted, but we'll find out in a couple of weeks. We'll see how it went.
It turns out the outlet reported he is cellmates with Juan Orlando Hernandez, the former president of Honduras, right, and a former Mexican law enforcement official. So there you go. Apparently, just thank goodness he's trading mackerel and he's not trading clients' money anymore.
Yeah, he's not trading crypto anymore, thank God.
I feel much safer with the Sam Bankman-Fried trading fish as opposed to trading clients' cryptocurrency.
Yeah. Much preferred.
But anyway, so that is the funny story of Sam Bankman-Fried, ever the capitalist, turning to trading mackerel. Good luck to him, you know. It's nice to see a young boy being entrepreneurial. I wish him the best.
Yeah.
But anyway, I thought I'd start with that little funny story. But the main news of the week, I think, Hamish, is what you're going to talk about, which is the US inflation report, because everyone's hanging on wondering if there's going to be these interest rate decreases. The Jerome Powell said we'd like to, but we need to see more evidence. We need to see more evidence that inflation is going down. So tell us about it. What's going on in the world of inflation, Hamish?
Yeah, exactly right. Inflation is it's been the story of the month for many months, the last couple of years really, and it kind of continues to be because, yeah, everyone wants to see interest rates go down, and if that's going to happen, we need of course inflation to keep trending into the healthy range, which is generally agreed to be like kind of 1 to 3%. Yes, this week we got February CPI data out of the US. The annual reading for inflation to the end of February was 3.2%, which is kind of slightly above what was expected. But interestingly, on a month-over-month basis, the rate came in at 0.4%, which was an increase from the 0.3% recorded in January. And 0.4% on an annualized basis, so if that was kind of what was happening every month for a year, is a rate of 4.9%. So in the last, and 0.3% in January is also very hot. So in the last couple of months, inflation, even though the headline number is 3.2%, that includes a lot of very low readings in 2023. Yep. And if you actually look at inflation over the last few months, it has been accelerating. So October was 0.1%, November was 0.2%, December was 0.2%, January was 0.3%, and February just then was 0.4%. So it's been kind of pretty steadily moving up, at least the headline.
As month over month increases.
Month over month increases, yes.
Yeah.
So that's something to keep in mind, is sometimes the annual figure can be misleading. Sometimes the, you know, the monthly figure is, it's, it is just a month. But sometimes the annual figure can be a little bit misleading because it can obviously includes, you know, a lot of the readings from, you know, earlier in 2023, rather than kind of what the inflation story is right now. And in the last few months, it's been kind of growing at a reasonable, accelerating at a reasonable pace.
That is definitely not the news that people wanted to hear.
No. And then, of course, we can kind of we look at the specific categories. So the 0.4% figure in February, that the accelerating inflation has a lot to do with the volatile categories. So energy in particular rose 2.3% in the month. So just in the month specifically. And then some of the specific lines, fuel oil was the biggest contributor, a 3.8% increase during the month. So oil is always quite volatile. And then gas services was plus 2.3% in the month as well. We can then, of course, look at core CPI to exclude some of the volatile categories like energy and food, and kind of look at the less volatile pricing categories. Core CPI, which has, of course, been above headline CPI for the last little while, came in at 3.8% and also had a 0.4% month-over-month increase, the same as January, which was also a 0.4%. So particularly when you look at the core inflation, it's still, you know, hovering around 4%. And again, the monthly rate at on an annualized basis is 4.9%. So that last bit of inflation is kind of proving quite difficult to get rid of.
And Jerome Powell said that he wouldn't wait, you know, he wouldn't wait until inflation is back down to 2% before he started lowering interest rates. But he definitely did say that they need to see a solid trend, a really solid trend, that it's going to hit 2% before they start to take action. So this is this is not that trend.
Yeah, exactly. And if you look at, you can go to the BLS website if anyone's curious, and they have obviously have a chart of how inflation has changed over time. And you can see quite clearly, you know, there was a sharp decrease from, I think it was 9% inflation, dropped all the way down to 3% in June of last year. It was kind of a very straight, consistent line down. And then since June last year, it's kind of just bounced between 3% and 3.5%. So it's been, you know, how many months is that? Like 6 or 7 months now, where inflation, at least on a headline basis, really hasn't gone anywhere. Core inflation has continued to come down, but yeah, on a headline basis, it's kind of sticking in that range between 3% and 4%. In terms of the contributors to core inflation, the biggest contributors, used cars and trucks was plus 0.5% for the month. Apparel was plus 0.6%. Shelter was plus 0.5%. And transportation services was the biggest category, plus 1.4%. But everything was up a fairly reasonable amount. There was only a couple of categories that were actually in deflation during the month. Most of everything was up. And and we'll ultimately find out what's going to happen with the interest rates next week. So the FOMC meeting, where the Federal Reserve kind of brings out their rate decision will be happening on the 20th of March, I believe. So we'll be able to talk about that next week and see what they do. It seems pretty unlikely, I think, at this point that they'll do a rate cut. At the start of the year, the market was actually pricing in a rate cut in March. It's no longer pricing in a March rate cut. It's pricing in a June one. So it seems unlikely, but yeah, we never, who knows?
That's exactly what I was just going to ask you. Hamish, what do you think next week? What do you think they're going to do? But I think you're bang on the money. Yep. I can't see them doing it. The trend's in the wrong direction. The one thing that they're scared of is that inflation starts heating up again. So I can't see them, caving to any sort of pressure to lower interest rates.
Yeah.
In fact, off of this data, you'd probably say the more likely thing that they would do is to raise interest rates.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, yeah, so you can obviously look at the bond rates, the bond yields, like looking a year out, a month out, 3 months out, and you can see what the market thinks, where the market thinks interest rates will be. And yeah, the market is still pricing 3, 4, 5 rate cuts throughout 2024. At least so far, yields have kind of slowly risen as the year has gone, reflecting like the fact that the market thinks there will be less rate cuts kind of slowly over time.
Yep.
Like when this inflation report came out, I think the 1 year treasury rate went, the yield went up 0.05% or something like that. So it kind of reflects like a small kind of change of heart from the market, and maybe we'll see that consistently throughout the year. Who knows? But at least so far, that's kind of been the trend.
Mm, very interesting. Bad news, unfortunately. What should we talk about next, Hamish? Should we talk about these banking problems, or should I talk about TikTok for a bit?
Let's talk about TikTok, because I actually know nothing about this. I mean, I've obviously heard whispers of TikTok potentially being banned in the US, but I don't know anything about what happened this week. So take us through.
Well, that's exactly right, Hamish. There has just been these whispers for a long time. I think most people have heard of this idea that TikTok might be banned in the US, and that's been, going on in the news for forever. But of course, there's, TikTok's still here. Years later, we're still here. We're still firing. But the discussions have really heated up in the last couple of weeks, really. And this article does a really good job at kind of just breaking down what the heck's going on. So I'll take you through it. It says, the US could be about to force ByteDance, the Chinese tech giant that owns TikTok, to divest its US business, or effectively they'll ban the app. But a sale looks unlikely, not least because China is expected to block it. So the House on Wednesday approved a bill that requires ByteDance to divest TikTok, the social media platform that it owns, within roughly 6 months for the app, quote, to remain available in the United States. This legislation is not yet law and needs approval from the Senate. Washington has long contended that TikTok poses a national security threat, as American data could get into the hands of the Chinese government. Lawmakers in the US are also concerned about the short video app's alleged ties to the Chinese Communist Party, which the company has denied. If the bill is passed, however, the Chinese government is unlikely to approve the divestiture of TikTok's US business. Quote, the problem is that the Chinese government is unlikely to approve this type of forced merger and acquisition, Paul Triolo, an associate partner at consulting firm Albright Stonebridge, told CNBC's Street Signs Asia on Thursday. Quote, any kind of divestiture and then merger with another company or acquisition would have to be approved by the Chinese government, which would probably reject that and is probably advising ByteDance that it would reject that. Wang Wenbin, a spokesperson for China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, said Thursday that the US bill is, quote, at odds with the principles of fair competition and international trade rules, end quote, according to an NBC News translation. Quote, if the pretext of national security can be used to suppress excellent companies from other countries arbitrarily, there is no fairness or justice to speak of. It is a complete logic of theft to see something good and try and take it for oneself by any means necessary.
So, interesting.
So, obviously I'm no expert on international law and international relations and whatnot, so I don't know what the legalities are as to whether something like this can be forced. But, I think it's just definitely come to the forefront now that that they've passed that legislation, or that they're halfway to passing that legislation in the US. But whether that actually means that it can happen, I'm not really too sure, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems it does just seem odd, just from a, you know, just like a capitalist perspective. Unless there is some overwhelming evidence that they're sending data back to China and there is a national security threat, which, you know, may obviously, you know, they probably are doing their own investigations and maybe they know things that aren't public.
Potentially.
But it does just seem strange. It is just a wild kind of concept. Especially because, you know, from a US perspective, I think the US government would be quite critical of China's restriction of US companies. You know, things like Google and YouTube and Netflix and all of these American companies that don't operate in China. I think a lot of people would be critical of that. So it's strange to see, you know, the US kind of partaking in that.
Mm. It says here, China is widely expected to block a deal, not least because this isn't the first time this issue has arisen. And this is what I've been saying. It's been going on for quite a while. It's just whispers and murmurs. Last year, the U.S. Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, the CFIUS, great name, told ByteDance to divest TikTok or face a ban. At the time, Xu Jiting, a spokesperson for China's Ministry of Commerce, said the country would, quote, firmly oppose a move by the US to mandate the sale of TikTok. And I think what the article goes on to talk about what complicates a sale further is TikTok's algorithm. This is the app's, quote, secret sauce, and is the technology that enables it to recommend content to users to keep them engaged. Last year, when the CFIUS told ByteDance to sell TikTok, China's Xu addressed this, saying a divestiture or sale would effectively mean exporting this technology, which must go through administrative licensing procedures. China would have to approve the transfer of the algorithm as part of the sale, Triolo said, something that seems very unlikely.
Right.
So they definitely don't want to give away the secret sauce so easily. But interestingly, we don't know, but there was a bit of speculation on how much the US arm of TikTok might sell for. You want to have a stab at what this
unfortunately, yeah.
You read ahead. Okay, yeah. You read ahead. Well, it says Angelo Zeno, a vice president and senior equity analyst at CFRA Research, told CNBC that it's possible that TikTok's US-only business could fetch a valuation north of $60 billion.
Yeah, geez, wow.
Big chunk of change.
Yeah.
Although, I don't see any of the stats around YouTube, around TikTok and their financial performance, but...
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe that's completely justified, but it sounds like a big chunk of change.
Yeah, I have no idea how much money they make, but $60 billion's a lot. Yeah.
But then again, if you told like Meta that you could buy TikTok in the US for $60 billion, I think they would jump at it immediately.
that's true. Yeah. That'd be funny. You see,
or Meta, YouTube.
YouTube or Meta buys TikTok. Yeah, crazy. That's a crazy story. Yeah, so it's passed the House. It's got to get through the Senate. I don't actually, who controls the Senate at the moment? It must be the Democratic Party, I think. So I think the Republicans must control the House, and then Democrats control the Senate. So, it's only halfway through. The easy part's been done, I think. Getting through the Senate will be quite difficult. Fascinating. Fascinating story.
Yeah, so that's kind of
what Meta and YouTube.
Yeah, that's kind of all the stuff that's been happening with TikTok. That's why you've been hearing more about it in the news of late. But tell me about these banking problems, Hamish. What's going on?
Yeah.
I've been hearing about this as well, but haven't done a deep dive yet.
Yep, the bank problems, they're not over, unfortunately. Different banking problems, but banking problems nonetheless. The story this week comes out of New York Community Bank Corp., which is the latest U.S. bank to be facing troubles. On Thursday last week, the bank said they lost 7% of its deposits in February alone, deposits dropping from $83 billion at the beginning of February to $77.2 billion at the end of February, which is obviously a considerable decline, almost a 10% drop in deposits in a single month. And this is the troubles for this particular bank, New York Community Bank, really kind of started back in January. So in January, they reported their Q4 earnings, and essentially they saw a massive swing of profitability from $207 million in Q3 to a loss of $252 million in Q4. So a swing of like $400 million just in a single quarter. And it was the first loss that they've had for the bank since 2015. So it was a pretty significant, pretty significantly bad earnings. It was the stock was down 60% in a day or something, an enormous decline in the stock. And it really comes not only did they report a significant loss, the why they had the loss is also really interesting. So primarily the bank's facing the likelihood of higher than expected losses from its commercial real estate segment, which is a very large part of the bank, particularly in office space real estate. They're expecting larger defaults than previously expected, and that kind of plays into the main reason why they reported such a significant loss and why the stock fell 60%, as they're kind of projecting forward now that they're expecting much bigger losses. And this is kind of an interesting, it's like one point of data in, or maybe like the first domino we're seeing in a much larger office real estate problem that's been going on, or that's starting to kind of evolve in the US, where essentially you've got a lot of office buildings being refinanced into much higher interest rates. That, you know, is same as we've kind of seen in some parts of residential real estate, especially in Australia. You had kind of these low interest rate loans go out during COVID. And for commercial real estate, the loans are a little bit longer, 4, 5, 6 years. So we're just now seeing the refinancing of those loans. And it also comes at a very unique time, while there is just a persistent decline in demand for office space real estate, because of this kind of hybrid work from home, new kind of work culture that's come out of COVID. So it's a really fascinating kind of situation where you've got higher costs coming in for property owners of office spaces, and potentially just a secular decline in demand for offices. Like, there could just be a permanent decline in the need for office space, particularly in expensive metropolitan cities, where people may prefer to live a little bit further out of the city and do a hybrid work option rather than having to commute and be in the office every single day. So,
yeah. And it's getting so bad that, like, the Blackstones and the Brookfields, are reading some article, and Steve Eisman's spoken about this as well, the Blackstones and the Brookfields, instead of bothering to go another round and refinance at, you know, firstly, because the values have dropped, they have to put up more equity. And then on top of that, the interest rates are higher, so they have to commit themselves to a worse cash flow situation from each property. So these big real estate investment companies, instead of like going another round and refinancing, they're literally just walking away.
Yeah.
They just walk straight back to the bank and they go, here's the keys to this office building. We don't want it anymore. And then ultimately, I mean, oh, boo-hoo, that's bad for the Blackstones and the Brookfields, but it's bad for the banks, because ultimately, like, who owns the real estate? The banks own the real estate because the banks give them the loans. So yeah, it is a cash flow problem. And a lot of commercial real estate loans need to be renegotiated over the next few years, I do believe. So it's particularly the office real estate, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's problems in all kind of parts of commercial real estate, but office real estate is the most egregious.
Because of what you're just talking about.
Yeah, because of this kind of potentially just permanent secular decline in demand for office space. So it seems like, yeah, New York Community Bank is kind of just one of the first big examples of a company, of a bank coming out and saying, yeah, we're starting to feel the effects of this, and it's likely going to be a problem for us for the foreseeable future. Back in January, they slashed their dividend as well. So the dividend before all of this kind of came out was 17 cents per share. In January, they cut it to 5 cents per share. And then last week, they cut it from 5 cents to 1 cent. So they've gone from 17 cents to 1 cent, which is effectively zero. They can, I don't know why they left the 1 cent there. They could have just called it a day and said, you know what?
No. We still pay a dividend.
Yeah, it's like the next cut's going to be, well, now we're going to pay 0.5 cent.
Yeah.
We're still paying a dividend.
Just pay a cent so that when the CEO just gets asked by random, oh, you guys still pay that dividend, right? And you'd be like, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, unbroken streak of dividend. Like they want to be able to put that in the press conference of their quarterly earnings.
Yeah, consistent dividend payer since 19 whatever.
Yeah. We did cut it 99.9999%, but we paid it.
We have paid a dividend every single year for our shareholders.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
So the story around why their deposits did see that 7% decline is likely a direct result as well, not only of all this commercial banking stuff going on, but because of what happened after their earnings, which was the ratings agency Moody's cut their credit rating to junk quality. It's obviously not good at all. And that seems to have been a catalyst because the next day was kind of the first day that the deposits started to accelerate and decline down 7% in the last month. Incoming CEO Joseph Otting told analysts Thursday that the bank would look to strengthen its capital and liquidity levels and reduce its concentration in commercial real estate loans. They also announced a $1 billion capital injection from a couple of investors.
That's right. Yeah, they raised $1 billion. Yeah.
Yep. So, and I think, yeah, I think not only that, but it's also important to realize that, you know, this is a very different situation to SVB and the banking crisis that was going on on last year. Most of the deposits are FDIC insured at NYCB. So it is a completely different situation. That was kind of a Silicon Valley based VC kind of bank that had a very concentrated number of clients and customers that were not insured. So a bank run was very, very, they were very exposed to a bank run. This is a very different situation. It's more as if they're very likely going to be facing significant commercial real estate stress, but a bank run is unlikely, although it's not impossible that people still kind of panic.
Mm. Yep. Yeah, it is a tough time for commercial real estate and office real estate. The one interesting thing which I saw, Jerome Powell did a testimony like last week. He testified in front of, I don't know, the House Banking Committee or something, blah, 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 some name like that. And I guess one positive is that one of their focuses right now is commercial real estate, particularly. And he said, like, he spoke as though he knew exactly what's going on. Like, he knows the office real estate is particularly the main risk factor. And the Federal Reserve is actually working with the banks that are most at risk. He notes that the big banks in America are not at risk from this issue. It's really small pockets of regional banks. He did say that there will be some failures. That's his best guess. It will be the smaller regional banks that might fail. The Federal Reserve is working with each one of them that's at a high risk to develop a plan to get them through if they can. The other thing he said is that his current estimate is that it will be a whack-a-mole situation as opposed to a domino situation. So as opposed to one thing causing problems for the next, and you get a domino effect, a banking crisis, he thinks it's more going to be isolated incidents here and there of regional banks popping up that will face problems as opposed to a systemic issue. But yeah. Very interesting. What's going on in commercial real estate, isn't it?
Yeah, it's exactly right. I mean, office, it is a big market. It's, you know, it's hundreds of billions of dollars, but office space real estate is a very, very tiny piece of like the overall US real estate market, which is obviously mostly residential. And then even within commercial, office is one of the smaller components. So, it's still a big issue, especially for some of these banks that are, as you said, regional banks that aren't that big, and maybe they have big exposure to office space. On like an economic scale, it is going to be probably an isolated kind of incident.
Yeah, people flinch really easily when they hear about real estate crisis, don't they? Yeah, after 2008, but exactly what you're saying. You think about 2008 was a residential real estate crisis. And this is nothing compared to, as you say, it's a small subsection of a small real estate market in the US. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
Yeah. All right, team. That will just about do us. That's all we've got to talk about for today, right, Hamish?
That's it, yeah.
Yep. All right, perfect. Well, thanks, guys, very much for tuning in, as always. Hopefully, the video and the audio worked out okay, despite me being down the coast. But hopefully you guys enjoyed the episode. Thanks very much for the half an hour or hour that you give us each week to tune into the podcast. Of course, we really appreciate your support with that. If you want to leave any sort of rating, you can definitely do that on our podcast. Everything helps out. Leave us a comment on YouTube or on Spotify. Any topics you want to hear about, that kind of stuff. But apart from that, thanks very much for joining me as always, Hamish.
No worries.
And we'll see you guys next week.
See you guys.